Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. We have with us on the line for the very first time my good friend Wade Hodges. What's up, Wade?
Nada. How you doing?
I'm good. Wade, I'm surprised that this is the very first time I've had you on the podcast. I made you suffer through like a couple practice podcasts, but this is the first real time you've been on the podcast.
You obviously have hit the bottom of the barrel and you don't have anybody else to call.
No.
Here. I know how it works.
That hurts, Wade. No, we've got a next three podcasts already scheduled. I think they're going to be some good ones, but we're excited about this one with you.
Do you care to tease who the next three are going to be?
Well, sure. We've got two gentlemen who are returning. Our friend Randy Harris has a new book out. I'm going to be in Abilene in a couple weeks, and I'm going to get with him, and we're going to talk about that. A gentleman named Pete Rollins is going to... is going to be on beginning of June. And then me and Jonathan Stormer are scheduling time hopefully next week or the end of this week. He's got a new book out. We're going to talk to him about that. So
nice.
That's what we got going on.
So how many of them have you done?
I think it's at 25, 26.
In how many months?
It's basically four per month. I've got a... bandwidth maximum currently right now that lets me put about four or five if we go shorter ones per month. So it's a 4 month we've done so far for the last 6 or 7 months.
Okay. And when you started it, this was a big what if. What if I did this? What would happen? And now you're deep into it. What do you think you've learned?
I can't get out of it. I started it and I can't quit. It's like, oh no. Yeah, I didn't know what would happen. I had originally kicked this around with you and a couple other buddies about, you know, maybe four of us doing it. And then I realized, you know, one person has to run this thing. It's going to be impossible to get four guys from different states to get a consistent podcast. And so, I think the thing that I've consistently heard is, wow, I can't believe you got so-and-so booked. And so people are always impressed for, you know, a new podcast, get some really good people, some New York Times bestsellers and Wall Street Journal bestsellers. But what people don't see here, like the numerous people who just didn't respond to emails or tweets or messages. And I think as a church planner, that's just normal for me.
But you've been pretty aggressive. You haven't been afraid to ask all kinds of people to be on this thing.
Yeah. No, I've asked some random people. Obviously, the consistent people who are showing up are... you know, Christian authors, that's a pretty, you know, traditional guess that we could talk about their book and talk about theology and church and spirituality. But we've tried to go outside the box and got one drummer from a band, but we haven't branched too far out.
Do you have an all-time dream guest that you would just love to get on here that you can't even get him to return your email yet, assuming it's a him?
Well, obviously Tom Wright. I don't even know how to ask Tom Wright. I would love to have him on there. And I've got friends, well, they're growing friends who have his email address, but I'm not ready to say, give me that email address so I can talk to him. I'd love to talk with Gladwell. He'd be a fun person to talk to. Yeah, I don't know. Who else? Who do you think I should talk to?
Well, I would pay to hear you talk to either one of those two. I'd love to hear you get Rob Bell on. I'm sure you could. You might be the one who could finally crack the Rob Bell code. In fact, this would be my goal for you. This is my vision for your life.
Oh, good.
You get Rob on your podcast, and you, with your persistence, bulldog tenacity, you finally get him to give a direct answer to a spiritual question. You could make a name for yourself. I'm the one who finally broke him of his vagueness.
Well, I don't know if Oprah did that. Did Oprah do that?
Not really. See, you could do something that not even Oprah was able to do.
Wow, that's a pretty lofty goal. I don't know if I could shoot that high. That's pretty impressive. I would love to have him on there.
I would love to talk to Rob. I love Rob's stuff, so it'd be a lot of fun. But I would imagine he could be a frustrating interview, too, if you wanted to get some specific direct answers to your questions.
Yeah. The problem with having people like Gladwell or Tom Wright, or even Bell for this matter, is they're just so much smarter than me that it'd be really hard for me to really trap them in a corner that they can't talk their way out of.
And how does that separate them from any of the other guests that you had on your podcast?
That's a really good point. Yeah, I'm not going to pretend like I'm smarter than...
You haven't let that stop you so far, don't
no,
you?
No, no. Yeah, I would love to have Bell on. He'd be fun to talk to. I'd be interested in hearing how he's going to shape his message with his new show that he's doing. And because he obviously built his crowd with the evangelical circles. I mean, that's who he grew up with. And then now he's got a different audience, and he's made some choices that have pushed him away from that target audience. And so now he's got to come up with a new group of people who are going to be interested in hearing what he has to say. And I'm interested to see what he's going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I'm curious because I know as you are interviewing people and refining your interview technique, have you found that, do you work from a script of questions, or do you have several things you want to ask and then let the conversation go from there? Or have you shifted your approach since you've started this?
Yeah, well, I started off with being pretty tied to my notes. Do you hear that in the background?
No. What is it?
I have a 2-year-old trying to break into my office right now.
Oh, okay. That's okay. I have a children's minister trying to break into mine right now.
Yeah, so when I started off, I was pretty scripted, and I had pages of notes that I would work through, and if someone asked a question, well, here's the next one. And my last interview with Ian Corona, I didn't have anything I was going to talk to him about. We just got down in a room and see where it went. And I think that's kind of the direction I want to go, is I want to be prepared. I want to know people's stuff. But I think as I get more comfortable, it'll be more conversations just kind of flow and we'll go where it goes.
Yeah. The last one you did with Corona was good. I listened to that. And I thought that was good because you didn't know where it was going. You guys were just talking.
Yeah.
I liked it. But that's always kind of what we've envisioned, I think, our conversations to be too, right? We're just going to get together and chat. And if there's something that's important to me, I can call you. I can put the bat signal up and we get the podcast going. Or if there's something that you want to talk to me about, we could do the same, right?
We've had that. We've had a few topics that we were going to rant on. I think House of Cards was one. We tried to get around, but the timing didn't work out.
Yes, we missed a golden opportunity, I think, to apply the leadership lessons from Frank Underwood to both ministry and nonprofit leadership. What a missed opportunity.
Especially with your situation where you actually are working in the very hometown of Frank Underwood's wife.
Yes, a detail that probably not many people picked up on when they were watching the show, but I noticed.
Yeah, Highland Park, that's where she's from. It's Claire, right? Claire Underwood?
Yes.
Yeah, her character's from right around here. Have you seen her walking around Highland Park?
No, I don't think she's a real person.
Oh, so I thought that was a reality show. It's not?
Yeah, that's also why Frank Underwood hasn't responded to your email to be on your podcast.
No. See, you talk about my persistence and bulldog tenacity. That's also, according to some court orders, stalking. So there's a fine line there.
Yeah. If Frank Underwood existed and if he were the president, you would be on a watch list for the Secret Service.
Probably so. How many Claire Underwoods do you know? How many Claire Underwoods would you encounter every day walking around Highland Park, Texas?
Not any. She's not true to life. She's a fictional character.
Oh, there's Wade keeping his job right there. So we try to talk about House of Cards. We'll probably need to do that when season 3 comes out.
Yeah, that'll be fine with me.
Do you know when that's coming out? Is it August?
No, I don't have any idea. I would think it would be longer than that, but...
You think so?
Yeah.
What else have we tried to talk about that we didn't ever get worked out? At one point, I think I texted you about Noah, and then I realized everyone in America has done something on the movie Noah, and we never wanted to venture into that crowd.
Right. Yeah. Nope, I still haven't seen it, actually.
Well, there is a book about it.
Yeah.
Genesis. Yeah. Hey, so what I did want to talk to you about was the new season of 24. You been watching?
Jack is back. Back again. Jack is back. Tell a friend.
Did you watch last night?
I have not seen last night's episode. It is waiting for me on my DVR, I'm sure, sometime tonight. After I have given the boys their medicine to make them go to bed, I will finally be able to watch it.
Did you watch the basketball game last night, son?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Spurs look good, don't they? So 24. So one of the things that you and I have in common is a fascination with the Jack Bauer type character.
That is true. Both in movie, television, and novels.
I used to have a John Grisham phase where I was reading a lot of lawyer books and Grisham stuff, and then I kind of evolved out of that with the Mitch Rapp character.
Yep.
Who was Vince Flynn's bread and butter.
Who told you about Vince Flynn and Mitch Rapp?
Honestly, I think someone gave me a copy of a Vince Flynn book, and then it was like the fourth or fifth one in the series. I told you I read it, and you're like, why did you read that one first?
Yeah.
And then from there, I think it was our...
I think I told you about it. I read my first Mitch Rapp book when I was actually visiting you in Panama City years ago on a beach.
Really?
And I think I even told you about it, but you were in your Grisham phase, and so you weren't interested.
Yeah.
And then when because you didn't listen, you ended up reading them out of order, which I don't know what kind of experience that was.
But I think it was the best book of Vince Flynn's that I read. The late Vince Flynn, who passed away last year sometime.
Very sad.
Yeah.
Not just sad for Vince, but sad that we don't have any more Mitch Rapp.
I know.
Unless, I'm hoping maybe that his family sells the rights or commissions of an author. I think he was about to finish one, and that maybe they'll commission an author to finish the book and carry the character forward. I would love that.
Yeah. So basically,
Robert Ludlum, the Ludlum Estate, has done with the Jason Bourne books. Same thing.
Yeah, I've read the new guy writing them, and
I have never. I love the movies. I have never read a Jason Bourne book. I have read several of Ludlum's other ones, but I've never read any of his Bourne stuff.
Yeah. Well, give a basic synopsis of who this character is that seems to be woven into the Jason Bournes, the Jack Bowers, the Mitch Rapps. Who is this character?
He's a loner, usually. That I think that's one of the first things. His high commitment to his job, which is usually protecting the United States or some other entity in the world from a terrorist attack or from World War III, his commitment to that job puts him on the outside of all other forms of community. He may be married, but it's usually not a strong marriage, or unfortunately, sometimes his enemies find his wife and kill her, and so he loses his wife.
Gotta hate when that happens.
Yeah, yeah, and it's amazing how many times that happens in those kind of books.
Yeah.
Or those kind of stories.
Yeah.
His commitment to his cause is such that he's willing to break the rules, break the law, in order to save people. And sometimes he has to do what he has to do. He has to go against his own government that's trying to keep him from doing it, even though his government needs him to do it. It's just they don't understand it yet, that he's actually working for their benefit instead of against them.
Yeah.
So he's this great misunderstood character. Everyone misunderstands his motives, misunderstands his purpose, his mission, and even the people he's trying to help are trying to stop him from doing what he knows to be the right thing to do.
Okay. So obviously Jack Bauer, he's a loner. He's the same guy who, I think season one, maybe he loses his wife. Is that right?
That was the closing scene of the last episode of season one. Jack saves the day, but loses his wife because there's a traitor inside of CTU.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And then obviously in this season of 24, he is choosing his cause over the law because he is fighting against, is it CIA, FBI, whoever, that is trying to stop him while he is trying to stop a terrorist attack on his old friend who is now the president.
Right, yeah, because he was already an outlaw because the series ended when it ended 4 years ago. He had to break the law in order to save the world, and so he became an outcast, a wanted man, and had to go off the grid. So he started out this season as an outlaw.
Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to get to is you also were the very first person to introduce me into, I think it's Joseph Campbell's Hero Journey.
Yeah.
Is that right? The Hero's Journey?
Yeah.
And so I want to kind of pair these together and see how Jack kind of fits in this hero's journey. So why don't you give a brief synopsis for what this hero's journey is?
Well, the briefest brief synopsis that I can think of, since I don't have my notes in front of me for all the stages, is you've got a hero that is called to a mission, called to a task, has to cross a threshold. Usually in crossing that threshold, going on the adventure, there's some kind of wounding there. There's some lesson learned. There's some beast to destroy, some dragon to face. And then having conquered the dragon, can then come back home and bestow the blessings or the boon of his conquest on those people that he was fighting for. So okay. There's this great, you leave your home, you go on an adventure, and you come back, but you do not come back the same person that you were, which is a huge, huge summary and oversimplification.
Yeah. And the basic idea behind the hero's journey, or it's also known as the monomyth, is the idea that it's this same sequence of actions that's consistent in just about all narratives. Like, all stories basically have this same sort of outline in it.
They all utilize some of the elements. They don't all utilize all the elements, but most of your great stories are going to, in some way, follow this format. Probably the most famous example, and this was intentional, is George Lucas and Luke Skywalker. His journey in Star Wars is almost step for step, word for word, stage for stage, the hero's journey.
Do you think he did that on purpose?
Yes, I do. I think he was influenced by, and I think I've read that somewhere. I may be wrong. I'm sure a listener will correct us if that's not true. But yes, he was informed by Campbell's work, and so that's part of the structure he intentionally used as he told his story.
Really?
And you see that journey. Luke is on Tatooine. Obi-Wan calls him on a mission. He crosses the threshold. Along the way, he meets a wise sage, Yoda, who trains him. He has to face his father. He is wounded along the way. But having destroyed the Emperor, having redeemed his father, now he's a Jedi who can bless the Republic, having accomplished his mission. That's the hero's journey.
Hmm. You know what it reminded me of is Stephen Pressfield, an author who's written a lot of really good fiction stuff, but also he has some really good nonfiction. The War of Art, which is one of his best books. I don't know if it's probably more popular than even, say, The Legend of Bagger Vance, which he also wrote. But The War of Art is an outstanding book. I'd encourage anyone to read it. I think I've recommended it numerous times on the podcast before. But he also wrote another book called The Perfect Swing? The Authentic Swing?
Yep.
In which he talks about there are the same story types that are just kind of retold. Like, you have the same story. He said his book, The Legend of Bagger Vance, was a ripoff of some... Do you remember? I don't remember the name of the story that he ripped off, but it's not that there are new stories. It's that you have the exact same, really outline, the template for stories that are just interchanged with new characters, new circumstances, new settings, but it's basically the same story. You remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. And even I'm looking over at my shelf right now that I think I've even got a book on my shelf, a writing book that talks about that there really are only so many plot structures any story can have. And once you master those plot structures, then it's just a matter of putting your own language and decoration on them. But there's really only so many ways to tell a story.
Yeah. Well, the reason I want to talk about all this stuff is, if I remember correctly, I think I stole a sermon from you in which you use this as the outline for the Christ story. Does that sound right?
That you stole a sermon from me? No, that doesn't sound right at all. Maybe that this was one of the sermons you have stolen from me.
Tomato, tomato.
Okay, fine. Yeah, that sounds right. I actually did. I used the hero's journey as a jumping off place to talk about the Jesus story.
Okay, so tell us more about how you got there.
It's that passage in Philippians 2 where Paul writes about Christ setting aside his godness, if you want to call it that, and choosing to be a man, choosing to be human, taking on the form of a slave, dying on the cross, choosing not to be equated with God, and then being raised and exalted to the highest place after that. It's that U-shaped story structure in the shape of the letter U. So he was in a high place. He was exalted, gave that up, went to a low place, a place of humility, suffered, died, and then was raised and elevated to a high place again. Mm-hmm. And just a form of, and even if you read the Jesus story in the Gospels, there's a form of the hero's journey there, that Jesus is called on a mission and he's baptized and sent on a mission. He crosses a threshold into the wilderness, and from there he's living, he's defeating evil, conquering sin, and then he brings that blessing, those rewards that he gets for himself as the Son of God, he then brings those back to the people so that they can be blessed as well.
So do you think that the hero's journey, the monomyth, is something that is a story that points back to the story of Jesus, or you think the Jesus story is our way of taking this myth and interpreting it into this Christ figure, this Nazarene from 2,000 years ago?
I there's a book that talks about, and I've read this in several different places, but this was one of the things that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis talked a lot about, that it was actually Tolkien used myth to help C.S. Lewis become a Christian. That C.S. Lewis, in his medieval readings and all of his studies, he loved mythology, and he loved these archetypes that keep showing up in all these different stories. So the kind of hero's journey, but he also struggled with it. Why isn't the gospel, the story of Jesus, why isn't it just another one of the myths, mm-hmm. that just like all the others? And I think Tolkien's response was something like, it is the true myth. That all of these stories have been floating around in our imagination, and that's why they're told over and over and over again, and yet that in Jesus all of these myths became true. And it's the true telling of the great mythological story that is a part of our imagination. And of course I'm butchering it, you got to get the conversation right, but essentially when Lewis could put that into his categories and say, okay, this is a true myth. This is, to use Campbell's language, this is the hero's journey that actually happened. Then that allowed him, at least in some ways, to cross that intellectual barrier, keeping him from faith or from becoming a Christian.
Really? Do you think people will talk in 100 years or so about conversations that Hodges and Norsworthy had, same way you referenced Lewis and Tolkien's conversations?
I'm not a prophet. I don't claim to be a prophet, not the son of a prophet, but I feel quite confident in predicting that that will not happen.
I thought you were going to go somewhere else with that answer. So what about the people who say, well, this is just wish fulfillment. We want this hero's myth to be true, this hero's journey to be true, and you see this popping up all these other different places in which we're trying to have this, you know, Messiah character who's going to come in and save the day and be altruistic and empty himself so that we can receive these goods and save us. What about the person who says, well, doesn't this point to the fact that the Jesus story is really just our ultimate desire to project this cosmic force that's doing for us what we want someone to do?
Yeah, I guess that's a way of reading it, and I think it's a valid criticism. But why is that such a universal projection? The very fact that it's universal, it always creates this question in me, that it's not just a few people who've had this. This seems to be something that's buried, this desire, this longing, it's buried in people's hearts all over the world. And has spanned thousands of years. I don't know why that's the case, but I think it could be interesting if we're all drawing this story from the same primordial soup, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. If there's a common source even for the longing for the story, a common source for the projection, I'd still want to know where did that tendency to have that kind of projection come from?
Yeah. I think to answer my own question, you know, Lewis has that thing about, you know, if the fact that everyone gets thirsty is true, then that confirms that there is water to drink. And if everyone gets hungry, it confirms the fact that there's food for us to eat. And so, you know, maybe a way to answer that is that primordial soup that you're talking about. Can you get that at Whole Foods, by the way?
Yes, but it's very expensive.
It is. So is this your way of saying that watching 24 in a lot of ways is like a Bible study?
I don't know. I don't know that I see Jack as this. I don't know that I place him in that same category as some of these great mythological characters.
Why is that?
Well, I'm just not sure that it seems to be a lesser story than that. Jack Bauer, anyway, I don't know that I put him in that category.
Okay, let's talk about it. What makes him not fit in that category? He is a loner. He chooses cause over the law. He's willing to push against CTU or the American government, whoever's in the way of causing him to not be able to save the day. He clearly sacrifices his life. He sacrifices his family's life. He's willing to do all these ridiculous things to protect what he believes in, which is his country, and doing what's right. Why doesn't he fit in there?
I don't know that Jack learns anything along the way.
Really?
One of the problems with 24 is the way the show is scripted and structured. There's no interior life to Jack. So you never see, he goes through all this trauma and never really seems to have to process it emotionally. Maybe there's some brief moments throughout the series where he has, but I don't know that he's any wiser than he was back in season one. He uses the same tactics. If anything, he's probably more suspicious and more skeptical. I think he's more violent. I even think there was one episode, something he did in a previous episode in this new series, where he shot some innocent people in the leg,
yeah,
which were protesting, but he shot them in the leg. And I, for the first time, I was like, I don't know that justifies what he's trying to accomplish. And to me, Jack is getting darker and darker and darker as the series goes on. And the hero's journey is in some way supposed to be a story of redemption, a story of transformation. And I don't know. I don't think he's learning anything along the way. In fact, that's the weakness of the story, is it's just the same story told over and over again. It's a cycle where a few new plot twists, but they just keep the same plot over and over and over again, and Jack is caught in it. But I think the question is Jack growing or learning or being transformed through the experience? And I don't know that he is.
It's almost like he is Breaking Bad, as some might say.
Yes, sure.
No, he definitely isn't growing. He's not doing anything different. He's not smarter. He's gotten Chloe back in the mess. This time in the hero's journey, there's always the little friend who helps out. I think sometimes it's referred to as the amulet, which is also in one of my daughter's Disney shows that she likes to watch, which is the only reason I know that word. But he isn't learning anything. He's not getting any better, which seems to be the centerpiece of all good stories, is that there's character transformation, and you don't see that at all with Jack.
Yeah. And I don't know that he... Of course, the show isn't set up to teach us this or show us this. I don't know that he's teaching anybody anything either. That the hero is supposed to come home and share the wealth, share the wisdom, share the insights of his journey.
Mm-hmm.
That's not Jack Bauer.
Who is an example of a character who's done that? A character that has... He's gone on this adventure, he's suffered, he's experienced resurrection, he's transformed, he's atoned, and then he's returned back home, a better person, wiser for this wear. Who's an example of someone who's done that?
I think any story in which somebody doesn't do that, it's easier to pick the stories where they don't. That all characters, Mitch Rapp has learned things, if you go back to those books and those stories, and how he started out and how he finished. He learned something about compassion and forgiveness. He had a chance to take revenge on the killer of his wife and didn't. That comes to mind. I'm watching Mad Men right now, probably one of my all-time favorite shows. And the thing that's frustrating about Mad Men is Don Draper at times can be just this terrible guy, but there are these hints that he is finally learning something along the way. And it's not just that he's learning something. It's, as I engage with other people who watch the show, that we all collectively want him to learn something. That if the show ends, there's only 8 or 9 episodes left last season. If the show ends and Don Draper ends up being the same person he's always been, I think it's going to be a huge disappointment. Because that's not a very good story. And that's certainly not the story that I've been tuning in and watching and actually pulling for Draper to say, please show me that you learn something. Show me that you're learning from your mistakes. Show me that you are being transformed. I think that's what we root for in all our characters. And that's what we want to see as they, especially if they start out with some really despicable traits, but they're that mix of good and bad, and there's just enough good to make you like them, that you're hoping that because I like you, I hope somehow you overcome some of these faults and you're transformed as a character and become a better person at the end.
Why do you think we want that transformation for these characters so much? Why do you think we want that to be the conclusion?
Well, talk about projection. I think that's what we want for ourselves. And in the end, we're watching these stories and rooting for people that we somehow identify with. And as they are transformed, then I think vicariously, we think we are somehow witnessing our own transformation, or at least feeding the hope of our own transformation.
How do you think that feeds our hope for? I guess you see an example of someone who's being transformed and you say, well, that could happen to them, so it could happen to me.
Yeah. Because I don't think anybody watched Breaking Bad and felt themselves going, I want to become like Walter White. And what we wanted was at some point, it was the opposite of that arc. It is, here's a decent guy who is going to become progressively evil. And while that was fascinating to watch, that was not the kind of story where you were rooting on Walter White, become more evil. Come on, become more evil. It was instead, I can't believe he did that. I can't believe he let Jesse's girlfriend die. I can't believe he got Jesse in trouble so that his other girlfriend ended up dying. And I can't believe that he's going to get Hank killed. So as all that happens, you're thinking, this is terrible. This is awful. But it's not something you're identifying with and saying, man, this is something I want to see happen in my life. Whereas the opposite arc, I do. I think there is some kind of identification that happens.
Well, I think that is a deep universal longing. We all want redemption. We all want the chance to grow. We don't want to be who we are. We want to be someone better. And yeah, you want to see examples of that.
And to that end, I think that is what makes Jack Bauer fascinating to some of us, in that, especially if you have ever been in a position where you didn't feel like you had a very important calling or mission in life, or you felt like your life wasn't going anywhere, the thing that is wonderful about Jack Bauer is he has a mission. He has a purpose. He knows what it is, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to accomplish it. And I can remember several years ago where I kind of felt stuck and I didn't have that. And I remember just thinking, that's why he's so attractive. The dude knows what he wants, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to get it. And there's something compelling about somebody like that, especially if they're doing it for good. They're trying to save the world. There's something so compelling about this is the kind of stuff people do when they are totally committed to accomplishing their goal. Yeah. I do think there is some identification, and I think that's why we root for Jack Bauer, because we all want to be that kind of hero.
Yeah. That's good. Well, Wade, thanks for following it on the podcast. It's been some good stuff.
Yo.
All right, man. We'll have you back another time soon. All right. Thanks, Wade.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.